discovered, I've had a lot more names than Toby Terrell.
Yeah, could you do that one more time? Tell me your full name.
Yeah, Toby Terrell, T-O-B-E-T-E-R-R-E-L-L. That's my real name, my legal name that I was born with is Robert Gardner Terrell Jr.
What are some of the other names you've used?
Oh, well, you discovered the one of Genghis K. Plato. That was my name very briefly during the what has come to be called the Goat Gate.
Yeah, I saw that. So before we get into Goat Gate, go ahead and tell us a little bit about your background and how you found your way to be involved in the group now known as the Finders.
Well, I grew up in Ocala, Florida, which if you're going south, you'll probably pass through Ocala. It's a kind of a blue-collar town, and had a very ordinary childhood. Went to college, got a degree in English literature, but found that I wasn't able to make much of a living with that, so I went back to graduate school and studied accounting, became a CPA. I worked for the IRS for 9 years and then left and went on my own and made enough money that I was able to retire at age 35. And I found by that time that I had done everything that my culture had programmed me to do. I was basically programmed to participate in the existing culture and make money and get a wife and two kids and move to the suburbs and then move into a bigger house and all of those kind of things. But that didn't seem to satisfy some deeper urge. So I started doing yoga and began to explore different approaches and was impressed by a number of characters that I met along the way. Chogyam Trungpa was very influential. I went to hear him lecture, and I'd never heard a monk before, particularly a Tibetan monk, and I couldn't tell you what he talked about at that talk, but I could tell you about his presence. I'd never met anyone with a presence like him. So I read some of his books, and one thing led to another, and I met a teacher by the name of M.D. Petty. You're familiar with the Game Caller book, which is basically about him and about
That's Marion Petty? Is that the same?
Marion D. Petty, yes. He also had many names.
Yeah, I see that.
the book is about my relationship and experiences with him over a period of about 20 years.
Could you tell us how you first met him?
Yes. At that time, I had an office in downtown DC. I was doing venture capital. And a young real estate developer came to me to ask me to help him raised some venture capital. I was putting together limited partnerships. So I got to know him, and we didn't ever make a deal, but I remembered him, and I remembered where he was working. He had a crew of a dozen people or so. And a young man that I had met on his way through D.C. named Michael Halperin had come back to D.C. and had asked me to help him find a job. He had been passing through D.C. on a famous trip around the U.S. in a group called The Farm. Have you ever heard of The Farm in Tennessee?
Yeah.
Back in, I guess it would have been about 1971 or so, the group that came to be known as The Farm gathered together a bus caravan out in California and drove around the United States with a bunch of hippies in the buses. We made quite a bit of publicity. It was sort of a fun event. Buses all painted up, as you could imagine.
Yeah.
And they got to D.C. and drove around the mall and around the Capitol, and it was covered by all the papers and so forth. And one of the buses broke down. And in this bus was this young man named Michael Halperin. And he met a friend of mine, and then they went on, fixed the bus, they went on to Tennessee, and his teacher there, whose name was Stephen Gaskin, he was the leader and founder of The Farm, told him that he should go back to D.C. because he had some debts, and that before he could live at the farm, he had to pay off his debts. So when he got to town, this friend of mine suggested that he talk to me and see if I could help him get a job, which I did. I sent him over to this real estate developer, and the real estate developer turned him over to the superintendent, who happened to be M.D. Petty's son, George Petty. George hired him, and Michael came back to my office to thank me and invited me to come over to visit this group of people who were all working for George and living in a community in D.C. that had come to be known as the New Ark. He told me that the door was never locked and I was welcome to come by any time and meet the folks, so that sounded interesting. So I did that, and I got to the door and it was locked. It wasn't supposed to be locked. But there was a sign on the door that said, "Knock loudly, nymphs dancing." So that was intriguing, and so I knocked loudly, and two women wrapped in sheets came to the door and let me in and ushered me back into the kitchen, and that's where I met M.D. Petty.
So prior to that, had you known George?
No, I didn't know George.
So you just sent your friend on his way, and he ended up connecting them and kind of bringing you back in through the...
It was the universe making that connection, yes.
So you meet Marion Petty. What was your first impression?
I thought he was the owner of the real estate construction company. He was... He had that presence about him of confidence, and he was in middle age at that time, and I liked him immediately. He was very friendly. He sat down and started asking me questions, and went on and on and on. I was very impressed by him, as he asked me questions, I realized that he was not just a real estate construction superintendent. He was a scholar, and so one thing led to another, and I went back to visit him again, and realized that he was a spiritual teacher. Based on the questions that he asked me. And so I asked him some questions as well. And then I was in transition. I'd been married for 12 years, had a couple of kids, was living in Chevy Chase in a very nice house in a very nice suburb. But it was a phase in my life where it was time to develop my spiritual nature. I'd been a householder, and that was a good phase. So to make that a shorter story, I moved in to the new Ark and never moved out. We kept moving around. They already had established a what they called the Invisible Bank, which was a fund consisting of M.D. Petty and his two sons and his wife and a few other people. And so I had a fair amount of money then, and I threw it into the Invisible Bank, and we formed a bigger fund, and we all shared. We took out what we needed, and we put in whatever we earned. I didn't have an idea of divorcing, but my wife wanted to divorce, so I asked his advice on what to do, and he said, just give it all to her and the kids. So I did. I took my share out of the Invisible Bank and gave it all to my wife and my two daughters, and they were very generous, and they said, well, we'll keep a fourth, and we'll give you back a fourth. So I put that back into the Invisible Bank, and we used it to buy some buildings. We bought a couple of apartment buildings in D.C. and a big warehouse over in the produce section of D.C.
Are these the same ones that would be raided later on?
Sorry?
Are these the same buildings that would be raided later on?
Yes.
By the police?
Definitely, they were. More than once.
Yeah. Okay, well, so you start spending time, you move in, you invest your money in. Can you describe briefly what's the day-to-day activities with the Ark, the new Ark? Because what's been described is, you know, different types of games and different types of play. Can you kind of elaborate on that aspect?
Sure. Well, everything was a day at a time, and I've lived a day at a time ever since then. And I've lived in the gift economy since then. We never charged fees for our services. We made a gift, and someone could give us a gift in return. Usually it was money, but it could have been other things. The day started with a morning meeting. We got together and we sat in a circle, sort of like this, but bigger. And when it was your turn in the circle, you could say anything you wanted. So we brought up options, and generally we would put them up on a big board, writing down the options of what we were going to do for the day. Everybody had different options, and then we would pick a leader for the day. And the leader would put the day together for everybody who had been in the meeting. The leader was sometimes picked by random. Most often it was a voluntary meeting. People would say, well, I volunteer to Barbara, and Barbara would assign people out to do whatever was going to happen that day. Before any of this happened, we would come into the meeting, and Petty would usually be in the meeting, and everybody had a little ritual that we would go through. We would ask him to be the game caller, because he would never tell anybody what to do unless on that particular day they had volunteered to him, because we lived in a volunteer society. They would say, will you be my game caller today? I'm ready to go in any direction. And So sometimes he would preempt what was going to happen in the meeting, because he was a highly intuitive guy, and his role as the game caller was to intuit some activity that would bring out the unconscious limitations that were holding people back from their own spiritual evolution. And the games were usually very simple. He would say something like, okay, take off with no money and don't come back till you have $100. And no instructions other than that. And then you just leave and do whatever it took to get $100. Not that we were trying to get the $100, it was trying to get the experience. Sometimes he would assign people to be in a particular group. In this culture, it's very difficult to turn yourself over to somebody else and just do exactly what they tell you to do. We're not programmed for that. And this leads to all kind of insights if you're open to get the insight. Sometimes it produces anger. Sometimes it produces foot dragging. Usually it produces some effort to intervene in what you've been told to do. For example, Petty might say, well, I want you to go down to the library and do some research. He would give us a topic, and then something would happen like, I need to make a couple phone calls and then I'll go do it. So this was your own ego resisting just doing exactly what you've been told to do. So you ask what kind of a day might be put together. They were all different. Every day was different. It was highly disciplined, but it was also very free and full of hijinks and fun games and trips, and, you know, it was a very lighthearted existence.
So you mentioned about moving around often. Was that a part of the games or the culture? What was the goal, the point or the goal of why were you guys moving so often or traveling so often? Was that just part of the culture?
Yeah, it was. We almost never slept in the same place for 3 days in a row. We had the warehouse on one side of town, and we had the apartment buildings on the other side of town, and then we had 600 acres of land in the country. So we were constantly moving from one to another, lightening our load. Your bags were always packed. You're always ready to go. So that was the local moving around. But there was also moving around to different places. The first trip I made with Petty was to New York City in about 1973. And we went with no preconception. I had contacts in New York, and we just went up. We stayed at the Chelsea Hotel a couple of nights, and we stayed at on it, some couches in the residence of Auntie Mame. Does that ring a bell, Auntie Mame?
Sounds familiar to me.
There was a well-known Broadway show called Auntie Mame. I think it was a musical. She was a very interesting character who sort of held soirees among the cognoscenti of New York City, the writers and artists and so forth at her house. And she and Petty had been friends, so we went and visited her. She was quite old at that time. She died shortly thereafter. And we just sort of explored New York and the alternative cultures of New York. I remember one incident that was very unusual. There was a scientist who was an early experimenter with LSD by the name of Humphrey Osmond. He was a well-known scientist in Britain, and he had come to the U.S. to Princeton University, and on this particular night he was giving a talk in Harlem. I think it was at the, I can't remember what it was, a church in Harlem. Petty found out about it and we went. And it was a very interesting talk, and it went on and on and on. There was a fairly good crowd there, and one after another the crowd drifted away. And finally it was 11:30 at night, and we were the only ones left in the audience. And we were asking him questions and getting to know him. He's a very interesting guy, kind of an eccentric British scientist. And we're the only ones left, and it's obviously time to leave. So we asked him where he was going. And did someone come? Did he have transportation? And he said he was going back to Princeton, New Jersey, which is an hour outside of New York City, and he didn't even have a car or a ride. So we volunteered to drive him down to Princeton. And that always stuck with me, that this guy was so in the flow that he just counted on the universe to take care of him, which we did.
I'd like to ask one more question and then move towards Goatgate. How was all the funding for the land, you mentioned 600 acres, was that coming from the Invisible Bank, people contributing and things of that sort, or did Petty like privately fund these things, or how did that all work?
He bought that land.
Yeah.
He was, he only had one job in his life, which was as a chauffeur in the Army. He joined the Army at age 13. This is just in 1934. And he was only 13, but he got his parents to lie for him. He was large for his age, and he passed for 18, or which you had to be to join the Army at that time. And then World War II came along, and he had worked his way up to a highly regarded sergeant among the ceremonial troops of the regular army. They were the ones who marched when foreign visitors came to the White House, and they provided the personnel for the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier and so forth. He was a very straight, good-looking, 6-foot young man, and he was part of that organization, which put him in the Pentagon every day. And then World War II broke out, and he had a good grapevine in the Pentagon. The Pentagon is run on a grapevine. And so he knew that Henry Arnold was about to become the head of the Army Air Corps, which would entitle him to a second chauffeur. So he went up to Henry Arnold in the hallway of the Pentagon and asked him if he could become his chauffeur. He already knew the first chauffeur, and that's where he'd gotten the information about the new chauffeur's job. And he said that he just stood there and gazed into the eyes of Henry Arnold until Henry Arnold consented. And that's how he spent World War II, as the chauffeur for all of the leading generals of World War II, which was a wonderful job because he knew what was going on behind the scenes. He was carrying the vice president or these various generals around town in the back seat of his Cadillac. And during this time, he was a thrifty guy, and he'd saved up his money and began buying land in the Virginia mountains, which was very cheap at that time. So he had accumulated 600 acres of land on a chauffeur's salary, which is no easy feat. So when Finders came together, he contributed that 600 acres of land, and I contributed the cash from, they had some cash already, but that was my contribution.
So you, what year did you meet Petty? What year was that?
It was around the first of the year in 1972.
Okay, so early 1972, and the Goatgate incident happened 86, 87?
87, 87. Yeah.
So you'd been involved with the Finders for almost two decades by that point.
Yeah, that's right.
So now I'm going to assume that everything that's written in the book is a fairly accurate telling from your perspective, so I could probably skip over some of that stuff and get a little bit to... I'm going to use some of that information as reference in this.
Sure, good.
But, okay, so let's skip ahead then to, you know, let's... At this point on the video, I will have already explained everything that happened, so we don't have to rehash too much of that.
Okay.
But I want to get more into your perspective on it, because in the book you talk about, you know, you kind of became the spokesperson to deliver the message to the media of what was, you know, what was really going on. I want to talk about the raid of the warehouses and the apartments in D.C., the buildings there, and your thoughts on why the police reports indicated there was what they described as high-tech equipment, that, you know, Petty or somebody had communicated a message to everybody as far as what seemed like a cover story about the guys going to Mexico for a school of brilliant children, the reports of photographs of naked children, or, you know, all these different things. In your perspective, were the police overzealous? Did they make a mistake? Did they make up things? Why were the initial reports describing all these sorts of things, which led to a media frenzy, led to kind of a panic in the locals and things of that sort? And where did they get it wrong?
Well, you have to have a little more background of what was happening in the culture at that time. There was a panic going on at that time. Now, what's going on now is that people are seeing a terrorist behind every bush. At that time, it was people were seeing child molesters behind every bush. There were many cases all that got great publicity throughout the country. There was a whole industry that was built up around identifying child molesters, most of which amounted to nothing. Was a famous case out in Manhattan Beach in California that made national headlines for months. And finally it all came down that it was all made up stuff that was put into the heads of these very young children. But the point is that there was the if you see something, say something culture going on about children. And so we were pioneers in trying to raise free children. And in order to do that, you have to be sort of clandestine, because if it looks like the children are not being raised in an orthodox fashion, you can get yourself into a lot of trouble. And we certainly were not raising our children in orthodox fashion. We never gave them an order. We gave them a level of freedom that children in this culture don't have. We raised them in a non-threatening environment in the country where they would be close to nature. And on occasion they would come into the city, so but most of the time was spent in the country. And so the police were aware of us. They couldn't figure out what we were doing. We'd bought this 10,000 square foot warehouse, and we would sometimes appear there in the middle of the night, and it just didn't fit any pattern. So they had already broken into the warehouse to try to figure out what was going on. And they had drilled a hole through the wall of the building next door so that they could see the second floor of the warehouse, where each woman had sort of like her own little nest. It was open, 5,000 square foot open space, and each woman in the group decorated it in her own way. And so the police, peeking through this peephole in the wall, concluded that we were filming pornographic stuff, which couldn't have been further from the truth, but that's what they concluded. And one reason that they concluded that was that we had some cameras and high-tech equipment. The high-tech equipment that you're referring to, this was way back before there was an internet. We were pioneers on the internet.
It seemed like it. You guys, it seemed like modern technology for Petty to be able to send you guys something. It said connected to telephone wires, which sounds to me like early internet, early, not Wi-Fi, but cable internet, basically. Is that what it, something along those lines?
Absolutely. It was called MCI Mail. It was the first email system. And
was that popular at the time, or was that something that you guys were kind of one of very small people to have?
We were pioneers in doing it, but it was a tiny little laptop computer called the TRS Model 100, and it had. It was so slow that you could see the text scanning across the screen. It didn't have a big screen. It was heavy, but it was only about that thick and about that size, with a little screen, and all you could send on it was text. And it hooked up to, I guess it was a Ethernet cable, or the predecessor of an Ethernet cable, and the way that was usually done was through an acoustic coupling, which went along with the computer, and you could put it onto the receiver and speaker of a telephone, and it sent out a signal, which was then picked up by MCI Mail and sent wherever you wanted to send it, to some other person who was in the MCI Mail system.
Gotcha. So I want to give you an opportunity just to answer as clearly as possible, and if you can restate the question, you know, just to make it clear for the audience.
Yeah, sure.
Is there any truth to the Finders, the New Ark, having involvement with trafficking children, with child molestation, with child pedophilia, any of these sort of things that have come up in the last 2 or 3 decades?
Absolutely not. Total fiction. I can tell you how it happened, that one of the people in the Finders, the new arc was that...
One second. Could you restate that and say what you just said, absolutely complete fiction, there's absolutely no truth to these claims and state the claims, just so I can have that clear, you know what I mean? Instead of me asking you, you stating that there are no child molestation, there's no trafficking, you know, say that in a full sentence for the record.
Absolutely. There was no child molestation, there was no traffic in children. That was a complete fantasy, a fiction. That, and I can give you the background on how that happened,
sure,
if it's of interest. Alan Schoen was one of the members of the Finders. The term New Ark that you referred to was long past, and we had become known as the Finders because we worked for Finders fees.
That's what I heard from, I've heard that from a few.
So anyway, there was a man named Alan Schoen who was a part of the Finders, and he met a woman outside, and they became close friends and presumably lovers, I don't really know, but let's see, what was her name?
It wasn't Paula Rico, was it?
No. She became a part of the Finders also, but Myrna Dworsky was her name. And she was active in the Jewish movement in D.C., and Alan was Jewish, so they got together, and she was rejected. He rejected her, you know. After a while, I don't know what was going on between the two of them, but he pulled away from her, and you know, there's an old story, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. So, he had told her something about our effort to raise free children, and she went to the D.C. police and told them that we were a satanic cult. And so they opened an investigation. I don't know what a satanic cult is, I mean, even whether it's against the law, but...
Was this in D.C.? Was this investigation? She went to the D.C. police?
Or yes, it was in D.C. And as evidence of the fact that we were a satanic cult, she took a police officer into the park. Our apartment buildings were right next to Glover Archibald Park, which is a 400-acre park in downtown D.C. It's a wonderful place. And if you walk out the back door of our apartment building, you walk onto a trail in Glover Archibald Park, and she took the police officer there and showed him that there was a circle of stones where someone had had a campfire. And this was the evidence that we were a satanic cult, that we had campfires. It was not us. I mean, I don't know where that came from, but that was enough evidence for them to open an investigation.
So I want to ask, we only have a few minutes, unfortunately. I'll probably follow up and maybe ask some phone questions if that's okay with you, just because we're on such a tight schedule. If you're okay with that, me calling you just in the coming weeks maybe or so, or maybe
sure,
after the tour when I get back home and kind of start looking at this.
Yeah.
But so you mentioned Goatgate, and obviously that's what the incident involving, they found pictures of, I guess, goat slaughters, children with the goats, and as you said, this kind of made some people uncomfortable, and they connected it to these claims of Satanism and thinking there was some sort of sacrifice going on. Obviously, in the book, you dispel those claims and say this was kind of just, you know, fanaticism. Did you know, were you aware at the time, or have you since become aware of any of Petty's, you know, you mentioned how he was pretty involved and knew a lot of people in the Pentagon and kind of ran with these different generals. Were you aware of any of his connections to the CIA or potential connections to the CIA? Because as I'm sure you're aware, in 1993, 94, the story comes back. The AP, Washington Post, picks it back up and says they've got wind that there's a new investigation looking into the possibility that the CIA squashed the investigation into you guys. Do you have any information or awareness or thoughts on that?
Well, I'm aware of that. That's what was published in U.S. News and World Report. Very poor investigators. They took the word of a guy who was discredited in the and had been fired for other reasons in the customs.
Raymond Martinez.
Yeah, I think
the one who wrote the report, the initial report that talked about some of these guys.
Yeah, and that was absolutely crazy, and he had no evidence for it. It was just something that he said. You know, if you're an investigator sent out to get information, you don't just say it, you get evidence. Well, his evidence was that he had seen some communication from Hong Kong saying something about buying children or some absurd thing like that. And that was his interpretation of a kind of communication that he knew nothing about.
So there was a communication to Hong Kong, but he misinterpreted it as your...
We had a couple of guys. By that time, we had evolved an organization that traveled around the world doing journalism. And we had two different people who worked for Hong Kong News doing freelance articles, usually high-tech articles. And they happened to be in Hong Kong when the whole thing came down. And we communicated back and forth by this predecessor of email called MCI Mail. And in order to do that, you know, it's very slow, and we developed a number of shortcut ways of communicating. So I have no idea what he read that led him to conclude that there was some kind of a kidnapping going on. But he did say that, and so it was picked up by U.S. News and World Report. It just so happened that I was working at U.S. News and World Report at the time. Very poor investigator. He didn't know that I was even working there.
Gordon Witkin, did you know any of those writers?
There's who? Three.
Gordon Witkin was one of the writers for the U.S. News and World Report. Did you know any of the three of them?
If
you
no.
What about the, because the AP also picked it up outside of the U.S. News and World Report and, you know, the Washington Post as well. And was there... And I mean, in your experience, did you ever see any evidence of Petty being tied to intelligence agencies? Because there are those who speculate, perhaps you're correct, perhaps the, you know, the child trafficking claim that was all exaggerated, it's part of the satanic moral panic of the 80s and that sort of thing. But there does seem to be some sort of indication that Petty was involved with intelligence services. Namely, a journalist named Dylan Brandt, he received, which he says is an anonymous governmental memo, which, you know, is kind of in the realm of unverified at this point, that talks about Petty being an Air Force intelligence officer in his younger days, not only a chauffeur, but Air Force intelligence and a number of different connections, which, again, at this point is still like an unverified report. But do you know anything about those claims, or did he ever share any of that information with you?
Oh, of course. He was, he was in the Army Air Corps, which became, after World War II, the U.S. Air Force, and he was highly regarded by the brass, and they asked him if he would like to become an intelligence officer. So why would he want to be an intelligence officer? And there's a lot like the intelligence service in being a meditator and practitioner of yoga. What is the goal of yoga and meditation? The goal is to discover in yourself a connection that is closer to the divinity than the human body. Human bodies are temporary. We are not temporary beings. We're eternal beings. Being an eternal being is a lifelong quest, getting in touch with that part of yourself, that deep part of yourself, is not unlike being an intelligence officer. An intelligence officer is living in a foreign culture. When you get deeply into meditation and yoga, what you're seeing around you is not what the average person sees. You know that you're not this human body, and that most of the people around you are confused, thinking that that's what they are, this temporary body that we've been given. So Petty knew this, and it was a kind of training that allowed him to cultivate this interior knowledge and to pass that on to his followers to think like an intelligence officer. And we did that. We thought of ourselves as not the CIA, but the DCIA, the Divine Central Intelligence Officer, and we were simply here on this planet gathering information that would be of use to mankind. So that's where that whole thing comes from, but you can't explain that to a person who has no idea of what you're talking about. So when they offered him a chance to become an intelligence officer, he took it, and they trained him in Europe for some period of time. And then his time was up. His 20 years in the military was up. And he resigned from the military and started his spiritual practice.
As far as you know, did he maintain any of those intelligence contacts, like throughout the Finders? Like, I imagine being somebody well connected to the military and traveling to Europe and having these different connections, did that play into y'all's effort to be able to travel, you know, and like you said, you guys kind of had a network for journalism and for finder's fees. Did he use those contacts to build this network?
Absolutely not. When he left the military, it was interesting how he left the military. He severed all ties with the intelligence community. He had been trained, but he never was assigned. When his training was over, he flew back to Washington and approached General Ira Aker, who was then the Secretary of the Air Force. And he told General Aker that he had instructions to please give him his honorable discharge. And he was highly regarded by Aker. So Aker asked him why. And Petty said, "I'm sorry, it's so secret that I can't even tell you." And Aker gave him the discharge, and he then severed all connections with the military. And none of this, I mean, it's absurd to think that we had any connection with anything governmental. We did not.
Is it possible, in your view, that he went what they call a NOC, a non-official undercover, became, you know, continued those intelligence, because it seems, you know, he's the leader, he's the game caller, and people like yourself are obviously heavily involved, financially invested in things of that sort. But is it possible that, you know, the games and the information that he was feeding the rest of the group were coming from somewhere else?
No, it's not possible. I mean, I shared the same toothbrush with this guy for 20 years. It's not possible. And think about it. We were as opposite to the goals of the government and the intelligence community than you could possibly be. Why would he have any loyalty to the very kind of thinking that he was trying to reject and overcome with a more humane way of living? He was not a capitalist.
I'd like to give you just a couple of minutes just to speak directly to the audience that's going to be seeing this. This will be like an overall documentary about like going into the history, kind of bringing it up, and your interview, as well as maybe a couple others I get, are going to kind of be like, here's the update. Because as you know, most people have spent the last 20, 30 years just speculating and not really reaching out to anybody who's been involved with this, and that's what I'm trying to do, is say, here's the story, here's what all the media said, here's what the police said, and here's somebody who was involved for almost, you know, 20 years, here's what they have to say. So if you, just as a wrap-up, anything that you would, you know, any finer points or any details about what the experience of the Finders was, why people shouldn't believe these claims, that kind of thing, please feel free to speak freely on that.
Well, people shouldn't believe anything. Belief is the enemy of knowledge. Discovering your own true nature is about knowledge. To get knowledge, you have to go beyond belief. You have to test belief. There's something called Occam's razor. Are you familiar with that philosophical concept?
Yeah.
Occam's razor says that the simple solution is usually the best solution. These elaborate myths that have come up online from conspiracy theorists are not simple solutions, and they make no sense to a rational person, particularly when there's no evidence of any of this stuff. There's no evidence of any of this conspiracy theory, and there's no motive of why we would be trying to help the very organization that we are trying to supplant. There's something that goes on in a capitalist culture that keeps you from wanting to know your own true nature. And when you are threatened by your self-image that did not come from your own core being, it's very easy to reject the truth. That's what we were all about, was trying to allow little children to develop at their own pace, not to be swept up in kindergarten and sat down in some foreign environment where their bodies are telling them to be out there running around on the playground and developing their relationships with other children. And instead, the teacher is telling them to lay down and take a nap or to listen to that, or this eventually weakens and destroys your own true nature. Your culture does not want you to be free. It wants you to be a citizen that supports the existing power structure. The existing power structure in the United States is capitalism. Capitalism is the enemy of your own true nature. We never objected to any, we didn't carry banners on the street rejecting or demonstrating. We had a basic Taoist orientation, which was to just catch the flow of nature, because your own true nature knows how to lead you back to who you really are if you get in touch with it. We were trying to keep alive that spark in the children that would allow them to educate themselves and to know who they were. So to do this, you have to be very careful, because the culture does not want that to happen. And the people who have been given power in the culture will try to keep you from doing it. It doesn't matter to me whether people believe that foolishness or not. You know, I'm not trying to convince people to believe it or not believe it. If anything, I would simply say, discover your own true nature. Smoke out these unconscious urges that were put there by getting you to play a role in the world rather than be yourself in the world. The training for the finders was to smoke out the unconscious neuroses, or whatever word you want to give them, to stop playing a part that was assigned to you by your culture and be yourself. That's dangerous. It was dangerous then, it's even more dangerous now.
Thank you so much. I would love to continue on, but I know that we're probably already past our... Yeah, I probably gotta get moving.
Where are you going?
We have our stop today is in Sarasota. So we have in the afternoon we'll be volunteering at a community garden, and then we'll be doing our meetup at a park in the evening. So,
if you have a chance in Sarasota, there is a beautiful Buddhist temple there. Have you ever heard of it?
I have not. Is it what is it? A Zen temple, or is it Tibetan, or just
no? It's oh, I can't think of the name of this particular brand, but it is a magnificent place. I would urge you to go by and just sit and meditate there.
Yeah, absolutely. I would definitely check it out. I used to go to